Well, 2 years into the pandemic, and we are still living in very unpredictable times. The part of our future that's really unpredictable is the part that involves the virus, because we've never had a pandemic coronavirus before, so we can't use past history as a guide. We don't know how it's going to mutate or how those mutations are going to spread. The part that is a little bit predictable is the human part, because we have had other kinds of pandemics before, and so we can use history as a guide there. It turns out historically, people do tend to stop feeling so afraid, and people do at some point start thinking a lot about going back to normal or ending the pandemic. And what people used to talk about as the new normal kind of changed into herd immunity for a while, and now the new word is endemic or endemicity. Herd immunity kind of fell by the wayside because these new, more transmissible variants made it really hard for us to vaccinate our way out of the pandemic without a lot more people getting on board. But what about making the disease endemic? What exactly does that mean? That's the topic of today's episode of Follow the Science, an exploration of science, medicine, and medical misinformation. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg opinion columnist, and this podcast grew out of a fellowship from the Society for Professional Journalists. My guest today is Aris Katsourakis. He's a biologist and epidemiologist at Oxford University. And he's the author of a recent opinion piece in the journal Nature about the meaning of endemic and how it doesn't mean harmless. But what exactly does it mean?
When I use the word endemic, I use the epidemiological meaning of it. And I think given that we're talking about an epidemic infectious disease, I think if we're using the word endemic with relation to it, that is the formulation. And to an epidemiologist, an endemic disease is one in which the proportion of the population that is susceptible balances out the reproduction of the virus, creating an equilibrium and a self-sustained and stable infection. It has to be self-sustained, it has to be predictable, and it has to have a set steady state. So mathematically, endemicity is achieved when R naught, the reproduction number of a virus, multiplied by S, the population that's susceptible, is equal to 1. And therefore, the size of the viral population, the total number of infections, is neither growing nor small nor dropping.
And so can you give us some examples of endemic viral diseases?
Yeah, sure. Measles is endemic. Lassa virus is endemic. Smallpox was endemic before we vaccinated our way out of it. Many rhinoviruses, common cold coronaviruses, are endemic. Doesn't tell us anything about how prevalent it is, right? You can be endemic and low prevalence, or endemic and high prevalence, and it can be harmful or not harmful and still be endemic.
So flu would be an example of something that, would that be endemic? Or because it sometimes can be a little unpredictable and we can have very big flu seasons, would that not qualify?
So I try and avoid talking about flu when I'm talking about endemicity, because we have pandemic, endemic, and epidemic strains of flu. You know, in 2009, H1N1 was a novel pandemic. It is now described as endemic because it's been around since 2009, and it's been around at relatively stable numbers. But then we also have the animal reservoir of flu seeds new epidemics on a fairly regular basis. So we also have fairly regular epidemics of flu. So, I mean, flu can be any of those. Essentially, any virus can take any one of those three forms, because ultimately, whether an infection is pandemic, endemic, or epidemic, it's not an intrinsic trait of the virus. It's a consequence of what's happening. Is that virus currently behaving in an endemic way, or an epidemic way, or a pandemic way?
And so it sounds like the vaccination campaigns affect that then. So measles, I think, would spread pretty widely if people stopped vaccinating as much as they do. We have an anti-vaxxer movement here in the U.S., and there are kids that don't get vaccinated, and you see outbreaks as soon as you get a certain critical number of kids who don't get the vaccine. So is the vaccine what is keeping measles endemic?
Essentially, yes. So by vaccinating enough people, we can drive a virus that was otherwise epidemic into an endemic low state. But that's not necessarily like it's not necessarily a natural endpoint. It's not something that will last forever. And in order to keep measles endemic, we need to keep vaccinating the world.
I think all these references to the word endemic in the popular press do reflect a desire to see some kind of endpoint. Something like the way we talked about herd immunity in the early days of the vaccination campaign. And herd immunity didn't work out very well with this virus because it's mutating too fast, but it doesn't mean that we have to be in emergency pandemic mode forever. Now, people sometimes talk about herd immunity when we talk about measles, that we need a certain number of kids vaccinated to maintain our herd immunity. And people thought for a while, or some people thought that the initial vaccination campaign against COVID would give us herd immunity before Delta and Omicron arrived, when we still had the older strain, and it did seem like heavily vaccinated areas were seeing a huge reduction in the virus. So how does herd immunity come into this equation?
So I think I'd like to distinguish herd immunity from herd effects. So herd immunity is essentially a situation where you have when you pass the herd immunity threshold, so much of the population is unable to transmit the virus that the virus will start to naturally reduce in prevalence because it's finding vaccinated people whenever it tries to transmit, and therefore chains of transmission get broken through this kind of herd immunity. For herd immunity to work properly, you need to be in a situation where immunity alone, in the absence of all other interventions, can still contain the spread of the virus. What we're actually seeing in the COVID pandemic, more often than not, is that a combination of vaccine immunization together with measures and behavioral patterns transiently brings the spread of the virus under control, but then something occurs that leads to the numbers coming up again, and that can be waning immunity.
Okay. It seems like we were on the way out until Delta arrived, but maybe that's not the case.
So unfortunately, the ability of vaccines to provide lasting protection has been compromised by the emergence of some of these variants. Yeah, I mean, in the early days, we were getting these reports of like 90-95% protection against symptomatic infection. And if that had held up long term, then vaccines alone would have probably ended the pandemic if we'd achieved the right amount of vaccination coverage. Unfortunately, while the vaccines are holding up pretty well against severe symptoms for most people, they're not holding up as well as we had initially hoped against protection from infection. So it's very, very difficult to reach herd immunity thresholds when even vaccinating everybody with a vaccine that is imperfect against transmission blocking is what's happening because of the emergence of all these immune escaping variants, like in part Delta and obviously to a much larger extent Omicron.
Now, Omicron seems like it defied predictions that I had interviewed many scientists over the summer, and they said, well, if any new variant comes along, it'll be a descendant of Delta because Delta is so predominant in the world. And yet Omicron seems to have come out of nowhere. Can you give us any idea of how you think Omicron came about and what we can say about the predictability of the future evolution of this virus?
So, yeah, I mean, Delta was an intrinsically much more transmissible virus, and that's why a lot of people thought that the next variant would come from this very highly successful virus. But as viruses spread through the population, they change the landscape for themselves by infecting people and making people immune. And so that is essentially what laid the grounds for Omicron's success. So Omicron is probably intrinsically it's debatable as to whether it's intrinsically more transmissible than Delta. If it is, it's not by much. Its main strength seems to be the ability to evade prior immunity. And it probably arose because the high levels of infection before in southern Africa had provided a strong selective pressure for a virus that has the ability to evade prior immunity to arise.
The one thing that promises to keep us from going around in circles forever is new technology, and that includes the advent of antiviral drugs that work pretty well. So most of us are well protected by our vaccines, and the immunocompromised can, in the near future, be much better protected by drugs. And that could also reduce the chance that a new variant would emerge in an immune-compromised person and start yet another pandemic wave. Do you think there could be a global effort to protect immune-compromised patients, maybe get antivirals to those who are immune-compromised preferentially, or do anything else we can to keep people from being infected for months on end?
That would be amazing. I mean, before antivirals, prevention, right? Like, prevention is always worth more than cure. So if we could get 3 or maybe even 4 doses of high quality vaccines to the immune compromised population of the world, that would obviously be incredibly valuable, both from a direct public health perspective in terms of their lives, but also in terms of protecting the human population more broadly from further variants. I think it would be absolutely crucial. And obviously, one of the biggest sources of immune compromised patients are HIV patients, right? So in a sense, the fact that we never really completely solved the HIV pandemic is a source of both public health and evolutionary problems in terms of the COVID pandemic.
Yeah. So do you think that the US and maybe to an extent the UK have made a mistake in not exporting vaccines where they're needed sooner and in a more efficient way, and in some cases actually throwing out vaccines because we can't get people to take the boosters that have been recommended?
Yeah, I think that's a tragedy. I mean, in the UK, we're just about to throw away a whole bunch of boosters because they're not being taken up as quickly as we had hoped. We could be doing much, much more to share vaccines. And ultimately, you know, until people all over the world are vaccinated, this pandemic will never truly end. So yeah, completely agree with that statement.
Do you think that it's worthwhile for drug companies to make an Omicron-specific variant, or do you think that we'll just end up with some other variant? I mean, if they had gone after a Delta-specific vaccine, then we wouldn't necessarily be in a good position to deal with Omicron. Could we end up in trouble sort of chasing after this? Or do you think it would be worthwhile for the drug companies to reformulate the vaccines as quickly as they can?
I think we're going to have to look into reformulating them. And the hope is that a broader range of antigens, so a broader range of vaccines, is also going to give more broad immunity. So by vaccinating against a broader set of viruses, we may end up having protective immunity against variants that don't even exist yet. So it's possible that through the process of updating our vaccines, we might end up having broader, robust immunity that kind of gets us out of this more long term, although that's not a certainty. And we may need to keep updating our vaccines.
What other measures should either people, individuals, governments be doing besides trying to get people to take up vaccines? I think at some point on Twitter, you talked about something, vaccines plus, but what is in the plus?
So in the plus is the fact that, you know, at the moment, because we haven't covered the whole world with vaccines that completely protect against this virus, but we do have a much better understanding of how to control the spread of the virus. You know, we know that this virus is airborne in its transmission. We know that higher quality masking, ventilation, and filtration are incredibly effective at stopping the virus. We've got tests, cheap, easy to deploy tests that can help us break transmission.
And do you think that, you know, things like eating in restaurants need to be shut down? Because people obviously can't wear an N95 when they're eating in a restaurant or even eating together with their friends.
So these kinds of things are all tied into the overall prevalence of the virus, right? So if you have succeeded in controlling the prevalence of the virus through very, very high vaccination, through much better building ventilation, and through masking more generally and testing, then it's possible that prevalence has been brought down low enough that some of these restrictions can be dropped. And if prevalence is brought down low, well, what I would call a low endemicity, so very, very low circulating levels of the virus, then certain events become less likely to facilitate further transmission of the virus. And obviously, you know, humans are social, and eating together and meeting together are absolutely crucial parts of our existence. So if we can take all the steps we can to ensure low circulation of the virus, then we can safely resume all the things that we like to do and are important to us.
In the United States, and especially the eastern United States, we're now in a phase of the pandemic where cases are falling fast, and it's not exactly clear why. It kind of looks to me like people are behaving pretty much the same way they did when cases were skyrocketing. There are masks in the supermarket, just as there were when the cases were going up, and the bars and restaurants are pretty full, just as they were when the cases were going up.
Public health measures are noticeable, right? The things that we bring into play are pretty serious. And also, I think humans' behavior during an epidemic wave tends to change over and above what's introduced, right? Like, I mean, people who feel vulnerable or who feel they live with someone who is vulnerable will just not go to a restaurant, like even if it's permitted, right? So people's behavior tends to change, obviously based on their own individual risk appetite, but risk appetite itself changes at the peak of a wave. So I think there are all these little subtle ways in which we do interfere with the virus's replication, and a threshold is crossed. And once that threshold is crossed, you suddenly go from an exponential process to a declining process. And that appears quite stark in all these case number plots. A viral infection is either growing or shrinking unless endemicity is achieved through having enough immunity. So we will be seeing these waves of either growing or shrinking epidemics for a while to come until immunity itself is sufficient to keep infection at a stable level.
Are there any governments outside of, or any Western governments doing a good job? Or are they in Europe, in the US, in Australia, is anybody doing a good job? Or is it only a limited number of Asian countries that are doing a good job?
Right now, I would have to say it's a limited number of Asian countries.
I mean, Omicron happened so fast. It was like Thanksgiving. We were on the way down, and then all of a sudden this new thing appears, and then within days it was exploding. So it seems like it was a tough one for people to deal with because there wasn't much warning.
There wasn't much warning, but we seem to be dealing with it in many countries by relaxing our public health response rather than strengthening it.
Yeah. So you mentioned you had a tweet about bad opinion pieces and bad news articles in the media. And I wondered whether you could give some examples or give me an idea of what kinds of things you think are causing problems or maybe are counterproductive in the media.
Yeah, I mean, I've been really, really troubled by this kind of narrative coming from certain quarters that Omicron is like nature's vaccine. You know, that we need it's mild and it's going to immunize us and it's going to solve our problems for us by making everyone protected while incurring a low cost. And I think that is it's scientifically incorrect, but also is encouraging risk-seeking behavior in people who buy that idea. And I think it almost seems like all the same arguments that were roundly rebutted at the very, very early stage of the pandemic about how, you know, letting the infection run its course is what we needed to do. That was robustly rebutted by the international scientific community. And now know that those ideas seem to be coming back to the fore under the guise of Omicron being this mild natural vaccine, which it absolutely isn't. It's a harmful virus. You don't want to catch it. You want to be vaccinated rather than acquire immunity through infection. And I think we have to stick to you know, the standard public health message: avoid and reduce infection, vaccinate, protect. Not kind of these chickenpox party equivalents of coronavirus. I've seen a news story in The Guardian describe Omicron as a ray of light.
Really? In The Guardian?
Yeah. It's like a ray of light of what the future, a glimpse into the future and things are getting better and that sort of thing. So it's It's not, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a dominant message, but it's a message you see not only in conservative newspapers. I mean, we had this, I don't even know where the Wall Street Journal lies in the political spectrum, but there was this article there arguing that we need to, you know, the more people we infect with Omicron, the better, and the quicker the pandemic.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes. So these kinds of news stories are I find terribly frustrating when we're trying to, you know, educate and help kind of convince people to take the safest possible sort of route.
Yeah, and it seems like out sort of when you get away from social media and deal with people in the real world, though, most people are, you know, don't want to purposely get infected, don't want to have a chickenpox party type of event, but, you know, have been isolated a lot and you know, didn't do anything for the holidays and want to get together with friends and are just wondering, you know, what's okay? Are two triple vaxxed people having dinner at home together, is that okay? You know, or would it be okay next month? And so I think in the real world, people are looking for just small ways to kind of keep afloat mentally and physically.
It's understandable. It is understandable. And people do. I mean, it's been a long time. And unfortunately, in my view, longer than it needed to be through this kind of slightly reactive public health response system and allowing case numbers to get out of control to an extent where double or triple vaccinated people have to ask themselves that question, right? Like it should be safe for fully vaccinated people to congregate in a space. It's only because the viral replication is so out of control in certain parts of the world, including parts of the world that are highly vaccinated now, that people have to ask themselves that question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think would be important to discuss or even just other topics that you think people like me in the media and the science media should be talking about more?
I think the main message I generally try and get across is that, you know, when people talk about when will the pandemic end, it won't end on its own. We have to stop it. And sort of understanding that it is us through our interventions, through our public health measures and our decisions that are going to bring an end to this rather than it coming to some kind of natural cycle that ends on its own. I think we need to take control of that reality and do everything we can to make sure we stop it.
Do you think that means that people will have to wear an N95 all day at work, in offices in different places forever, and kids will have to wear them in school forever? Or do you think that when it ends, we can be a little more normal?
Oh, I hope not. I mean, I don't think this should last forever, but I do think it's unfortunately something we do need to be doing when infection numbers are out of control. But I don't think the future should involve permanent masking all the time. No, but it may involve masking in public transports in the winter, for example, or something like that. So, you know, where things will settle will depend on how much we solve things now and how much we allow variants to get ahead of us and defeat our response.
I also wrote a column based on this interview, and there I combined it with some discussion of a New York Times article that goes way back to May of 2020 called How Pandemics End. And in that article, historians of medicine talked about the way that pandemics can have both a medical ending and a social one. And sometimes the social one comes when people are still getting infected. The social end comes when people stop being so afraid and start to weigh safety from the virus with other aspects of their life, including other health priorities, education, career, family, and friendships. And I think in many places, public health policy is going to have to work with the fact that the social end is happening, because I think it's going to be really hard to hold it back.
Thank you for listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam. You can follow Faye on Twitter at Faye Flam. That is FAYEFLAM. Today's episode was edited by Seth Glicksman, with music by Kyle Imperator. If you liked today's episode, we'd really love it if you left us a positive rating and review wherever you listened. Thanks in advance, and we'll see you next week.